feel, if you recall, so minoring in physics was arguably pointless. Or was it? I did it for three reasons. One, because it interests me. Two, because I believe in self-improvement. And while liberal arts classes expand the mind, you need science and math to sharpen the mind. And three, because I've always believed that there is reward in challenging yourself, even if it's not immediately apparent. The journey itself may be the reward. Doing something hard is the reward. Maybe I did it just so I could fill a small part of this book talking about it. Who knows? I just know I don't regret it. The way studying physics sharpens the mind, it also turns out that purposeful suffering might actually change your health, your genetic expression, and your brain. The study of neuroplasticity has shown how mental activity, our thoughts, can actually make meaningful changes to your brain. And the study of epigenetics has shown that our thoughts, actions, and habits can influence the way our genes are expressed. This goes against the notion that we are totally captive to our genetic makeup, instead suggesting we have far more power over our physiology than previously thought. As it pertains to the nature versus nurture debate, it turns out nurture, meaning our environment, can be very influential on our physiology. It's widely accepted, for instance, that an exercise routine has a plethora of health benefits, controlling weight, reducing risk of disease, and relieving stress. Epigenetics helps us understand how exercise helps prevent disease and dysfunction by signaling to your DNA that it should produce certain proteins with health benefits. One study, for instance, links exercise to the production of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which enhances memory and the growth of nerve cells. I think it goes without saying that a healthier brain is a tougher brain. So, start exercising. Taking this argument a step further, Dr. Caroline Leaf argues that our thoughts can act as the signal switch for our genes in the way that other external stimuli can. After all, our thoughts manifest in electromagnetic and chemical signals, and those react with our DNA. An example is the CREB gene, which is switched on by merely thinking about it. This results in the production of proteins in the brain's frontal lobe cells, which grow protein branches that hold memories. Additionally, the psychological literature suggests that positive changes in character formation can result from traumatic events. M. Elizabeth Lewis Hall, Richard Langer, and Jason McMartin write, "In fact, positive changes have been reported empirically following chronic illness, heart attacks, breast cancer, bone marrow transplants, HIV and AIDS, rape and sexual assault, military combat, maritime disasters, plane crashes, tornadoes, shootings, bereavement, injury, recovery from substance addiction, and in the parents of children with disabilities. This type of change is known in the psychological literature by a number of labels: post-traumatic growth, stress-related growth, positive adjustment, positive adaptation, and adversarial growth. The idea is that it is through the process of struggling with adversity that changes may arise that propel the individual to a higher level of functioning than that which existed prior to the event." This is all a bit scientific, but the broader point is this: you have control over your thoughts, and your thoughts are more powerful than you may realize. Healthy habits create a healthy mind, and a healthy mind creates healthy people. Doing something hard is the habit of building mental calluses so that when life happens, you are better prepared for it. In prior generations, this lesson would not have been necessary. Life was harder then. Today, the miracle of modernity, relative peace, and the pursuit of creature comforts has made hardship a rarer thing. So how, then, do we embrace this lesson in a society that seeks to strip hardship away at every opportunity? Well, I'm not saying you should seek out traumatic experiences, attend BUDS, or take classes in quantum physics. Heck, most of the people who attend BUDS shouldn't attend BUDS. The dropout rate is high by design. I'm not saying you have to engage in hard labor for a summer. However, if you are physically capable of it, I would strongly suggest it. I'm not saying the challenges you seek must be physical in nature, given that not everyone is physically healthy enough to join a CrossFit class, run a marathon, or hike up a mountain. If you can do these things, I recommend that you do. Physical suffering, with purpose in mind, is a truly transformational path to mental health and meaning. What you should do is scatter challenges throughout your life. The nature and value of those challenges depend upon you. And those aren't singular big goal challenges either. The pursuit of meaningful suffering must be habitual. It must be a new part of your routine, where you dedicate yourself to occasional bouts of self-imposed suffering because deep down, you know you have become too soft. Maybe what challenges you is finally getting that college degree finished. Maybe it's beginning and sticking with an exercise program. Maybe it's sleeping on the floor or even outside, away from the comforts of your home. Maybe it's running a marathon. Maybe it's learning a new skill or finishing a major household project. Maybe it's embracing and practicing an ethic of forgiveness with people you despise. Maybe it's devoting yourself to a charity. Maybe it's walking up the escalator, not riding it. Maybe it's proving to yourself that you can fast for a full day. Maybe it's finding out how much you have to sprint before your legs give out. Maybe it's a polar bear plunge or taking a cold shower once a week. Maybe it's making amends with an old friend or family member. It's valuable to emphasize something here. The challenge must be self-imposed. There are a few reasons for this. The first is that your hardship needs to be habitual. Good habits cannot be forced upon you, at least not in the Aristotelian sense. And the hardening of the mind and body is not something that can be done only once. It must be built up consistently and with regularity. Those dumbbells aren't going to lift themselves, after all, and the longer you wait, the harder they become to lift. Pain should not be avoided just because it is pain. Voluntary hardship, say, willfully immersing yourself in an ice bath, elicits a totally different psychological response than involuntary hardship, someone forcing you into an ice bath. I think we know this intuitively. Research also suggests that the physiological reaction is different and more beneficial when the stress is voluntary and a sense of control over one's fate is present. In The Truth About Stress, Angela Patmore writes, "A number of key studies in the stress literature have highlighted the importance of control in the vulnerability to illness from distressing experiences. Stress, at the right dose and frequency, can make you stronger. But the voluntary aspect is important. Voluntary stress is purposeful suffering, and involuntary hardship is just torture. We cannot expect someone to engage in habitual involuntary hardship. While the same result of increased mental toughness might be achieved by, say, an IED exploding in your face, I would not recommend it. No sane leader, teacher, instructor, or coach would advise that you place yourself in an unsafe situation just to see if you can survive an unsafe situation. Arduous swimming is good. Arduous swimming on a beach closed due to shark sightings is bad. Voluntary hardship builds resiliency, so that when the involuntary suffering comes, you are better prepared. The saying, no pain, no gain, gets at the heart of this lesson more clearly. As the Buds instructors gleefully remind us, pain is weakness leaving your body. The more pain you endure, the stronger you become. Suffering now pays off later. Carl Jung, the renowned psychologist, summed it up. The foundation of all mental illness is the avoidance of true suffering. And this isn't a new idea, by the way. Ancient Stoic practitioners believed in practicing misfortune. Seneca, advisor to Nero and one of Rome's greatest minds, suggested that a certain number of days each month should be dedicated to practicing poverty. In other words, removing yourself from your normal comforts. The point of this exercise is to desensitize yourself to the misfortunes that life inevitably confronts you with. It is meant to remove uncertainty from future hardship and therefore dampen the emotions of fear and anxiety that accompany such uncertainty. In short, you will be ready for it. During a particularly grueling workout circuit at my local gym in Houston, I was asked by one of the trainers what I was training for. I wasn't training for anything, I thought. So I said, life. Training for life. He nodded with approval. Challenging yourself and engaging in purposeful suffering delivers a sense of meaning. But there are more practical benefits as well. At the heart of the Stoics' lesson isn't necessarily the pursuit of meaning, but the pursuit of preparedness through suffering. Preparedness for what? Life, that's what. Life happens, and you can't stop it, but you can control how you react to it. If you have already proven to yourself that you can fast for a whole day, then it will be easier to do when you get stranded on a desert island. If you prove to yourself that you can survive a night sleeping on the floor without indoor plumbing or electricity, then that same situation, if forced upon you, will be less shocking and debilitating. All those masochistic weekend warriors running Spartan races aren't doing it for the t-shirt at the end. They are doing it for the experience of suffering. They love it. Not only does it give them meaning, even if temporary, it gives them confidence. Not only does it give them confidence, it gives them a sense of preparedness for the future. We know this as SEALs. We train as hard as possible so that we are ready, both physically and mentally, for the real thing. In training, we often mimic the worst possible scenarios: ambushed, outnumbered, broken radios, wounded teammates. We watch as our teammates get wounded or killed over and over again in training. Before Jocko Willink was famous for his public message about extreme ownership and personal discipline, he was famous in the SEAL teams for prescribing training scenarios that simulated killing half the platoon and put us in the worst situations imaginable. It's not morbid, it's real-life scenario training. And when it happens for real, we aren't paralyzed. We know what to do. If finding your own hardship is beneficial, then finding it with others is even better. There's a reason CrossFit gyms charge preposterous sums for the privilege of making groups of people come together and do simple exercises until they vomit. People aren't paying for the exercise, though many of them will insist up and down that they are. People are paying for the most precious thing we all yearn for inside: community. When you do something hard, you find meaning. When you do something hard with someone else, you find meaning in community. The fiercest bonds are forged in the hottest fires. There's a reason that many corporate team-building exercises involve difficult challenges conducted as a team. In fact, some companies pay good money to retired SEALs to send their staff to the Coronado Beach, where they are put through a small taste of Bud's suffering. People actually pay for this suffering because it works. Dr. Allison observes, "Suffering brings people together and is much better than joy at creating bonds among group members. Misery doesn't just love miserable company. Misery helps alleviate the misery in the company." When you have meaning and community, either or both, then cheap outrage becomes increasingly difficult to generate. It is no accident, I think, that the most vocal members of the outrage mob, the angriest and the most passionate, tend to be those with the easiest lives. Few places on earth are as sheltered and accommodating and insulated from adversity as an American college campus. And college campuses are the petri dishes where most outrage and protest and grievances multiply and spread. That doesn't mean I discount individual suffering and challenges, far from it. The utility of suffering should not immunize us from compassion for those who are suffering against their will. Everyone has a story of some hardship that they hide from the world, and we should not diminish that. But the reality is that modern outrage culture corresponds with an America and a way of life that is easier than it has ever been. We are wealthier, more connected, albeit superficially, more entertained, more fed, and freer than we have ever been in all of human history. It is not a coincidence that we are also unhappier. Our societal unhappiness, increasing suicide rates, increasing rates of depression, decreasing trust in our institutions and in one another, has many causes. The declines of religion and the family, and the replacement of community activities with social media, to name a few. But I think it is worth noting that a loss of perspective about suffering also plays a role. We have liberated ourselves from suffering to an extraordinary degree. A man whose great-great-great-grandfather arrived in America an emaciated skeleton and refugee from the Irish potato famine today can have any type of food delivered to his front door 24 hours a day, and he has never in his entire life wondered where the next meal is coming from. Moreover, where his ancestor endured a monotonous diet of a few unseasoned root vegetables, he enjoys meats and processed foods of exceptional caloric content, nutritional value, and flavor. The ancestor objectively suffered more, but the descendant finds less meaning in his life and is decidedly less grateful. In fact, there is a reasonable chance the descendant spends a decent amount of his time raving on Twitter at the latest controversy, weighing in with uninformed but highly opinionated snark and sass. He doesn't suffer in any real way, and he is outraged. His problems are small, but his emotions are not. They are elevated, outsized, and shared across cyberspace. The loss of suffering, this perpetual quest to remove all obstacles and hardships from our paths, has allowed people to find grievance in the small things, or worse for the mind and soul, find grievance in things they have no ability to change. This modern descendant may work a dead-end job and believe it is big banks or failed foreign policy that blunts his progress. He rails about foreign aid to Israel and corporate bailouts. He could control the direction of his life, enroll in community college or trade school, work hard, and become a partner worthy of marriage. Instead, he focuses on that which he cannot control. Or imagine an affluent Yale undergrad, clothed in expensive designer wear and partaking in thousands of dollars worth of therapy a month. They are utterly convinced they have been victimized by a sinister patriarchy and capitalist corporate interests, all while conveniently failing to acknowledge the daily comforts they enjoy or the gratitude they should feel for the wonders of modernity and the Western civilization that created it. Alas, they are simply unable to guess why their therapist can't cure their anxiety and anger. I'm not suggesting that the solution for these lost souls is to return to yestergear with high infant mortality, Byzantine medicine, archaic gender roles, and all the deprivation and sorrow that accompanied those challenging times. Romanticizing the past is no way to cure the present. That's not my argument. But I do believe we need to understand suffering. And we need to understand what doing hard things did for generations that were happier, less anxious, and less prone to suicide and self-harm than modern America. Then, having understood it, we need to seek those challenges in new and constructive ways. St. John Paul II said, "Human suffering has reached its culmination in the Passion of Christ, and at the same time, it has entered into a completely new dimension and a new order. It has been linked to love, to that love which creates good, drawing it out by means of suffering, just as the supreme good of the redemption of the world was drawn from the cross of Christ, and from that cross constantly takes its beginning. The cross of Christ has become a source from which flow rivers of living water." For Christians, our faith was founded on the ultimate act of suffering, the example set by Jesus of Nazareth during his passion and crucifixion. Sacrifice to the gods, whether human or animal, was instrumental to most polytheistic faiths and even Judaism prior to Christ's arrival. And his sacrifice, the sacrifice of the Son of God, was so profound, so extraordinary, that it made all other sacrifices seem trite and meaningless in comparison. It was a sacrifice rooted in suffering, done on behalf of the sins of man, to take them upon himself and offer redemption to mankind. This was, as St. John Paul II had it, the ultimate act of love and mercy. Romans 5:3 states, "We glory in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope." In short, suffering has both moral value and spiritual worth. This is not exclusive to Judaism and Christianity, as I've demonstrated with the psychological literature. There is both secular and theological evidence that suffering has an immutable moral value and is indispensable to developing higher consciousness and better character. We know this intuitively also, as every parent will tell you that raising a child is simultaneously the most challenging and the most fulfilling experience of their lives. In the Christian sense, without suffering, there can be no redemption, no mercy. In the raw humanistic sense, without suffering, there can be no internal resilience to adversity, no proper preparedness for the future, Suffering controlled by you and for the right cause can be a building block for both spiritual health and mental toughness. In a liberty-based nation like the United States, where we are free to fail and to suffer, that fortitude is a welcome and necessary attribute. Rather than trying to erase suffering at every opportunity, we would all be wise to value it and seek it out. So go do something hard. Chapter 9, The Stories We Tell Ourselves. I recounted in detail how my dream to become a SEAL came to be. I read a book, I internalized it, I made it my goal. I had no plan B. But I didn't tell you about the other half of that goal, the part of that goal that never came to be. Becoming a SEAL officer requires a commission as a naval officer. There are only three ways to obtain that commission: the Naval Academy, Naval Reserve Officer Training Corps, or NROTC, or Officer Candidate School, or OCS. OCS is for candidates who already have a college degree, so this option was out for a guy graduating high school. As you know, I was commissioned through NROTC after graduating Tufts University. But here's the thing. It wasn't my first choice. My first choice was the Naval Academy. I failed to get in. My second choice was Rice University. I failed to get in. If you've been paying attention, you know that wasn't my first failure, nor my first encounter with hardship. I failed to make the cut for my old Houston soccer team, for which I was a shoo-in. In high school, having recovered my confidence and making it as a starting forward on an all-Columbian soccer team, I failed to make the winning goal during a tie-breaking shootout in our most important game against our fiercest rival. I lost my mom to breast cancer when I was 10 years old. I failed to get good enough grades in high school to become valedictorian. Maybe if I had, I would have made it into the Naval Academy. I broke my leg in Hell Week. I lost my eye to an IED. I lost my career to a Navy bureaucracy that no longer had a place for a SEAL with damaged vision. And after all that, with a Harvard master's degree to boot, I still failed to be nominated for a White House fellowship in 2017. Beyond that, I fail every day in some way. I overreact. I sleep in too late. I don't read that book I promised myself I would finish by the end of the week. In this chapter, I will sometimes use the terms failure and suffering interchangeably. Not because they are the same thing, but because the point of this chapter is to discover the importance of our reactions to those two words. After every failure, after every hardship, we create a personal narrative to account for that moment. We tell ourselves a story. We may not control the event itself, though we probably have more control than we think. But we certainly control the story that comes out of it. The new narrative goes something like this. I didn't have time to finish that book, or maybe I didn't make enough time. I lost my eye to an IED, or maybe I failed to get out of the way when the bomb went off. I lost my career in the Navy, or maybe I failed to make my case strongly enough. I broke my leg in Hell Week. Or maybe I failed to do enough strength training so that my muscles wouldn't fail. It's hard to tell a story of failure after my mother's death, but I can certainly take responsibility for my reactions to it. I take on this perspective because it gives me control, accountability, empowerment, and therefore freedom. Jordan Peterson, a renowned clinical psychologist, writes in 12 Rules for Life, "If you buy the story that everything terrible just happened on its own, with no personal responsibility on the part of the victim, you deny that person all agency in the past and, by implication, in the present and future as well. In this manner, you strip him or her of all power. The wrong story leads to disempowerment. You could tell the story of my life as a succession of hard times and heavy burdens. You could tell it as an array of kicks to the head interspersed with failures. My mom died, my leg broke, my eye got blown out, My active commission got taken away. My fellowship application got denied. All these things are factually accurate. They happened. I endured them. This is where a lot of people would leave it. These are things that happened to them, from forces beyond their control. Leaving it there communicates a handful of ideas about someone. He's unfortunate. He's unlucky. He's beaten. He's a victim. That is not where people should leave it. Stories about burdens borne on their own omit the most important parts. The responsibility of the individual, the reaction of the individual, the growth and maturing of the individual. The world does something to you because it will always do something to you. But once it's done, that share of the story is over. That's where your share of the story begins. That's the point where the story stops being something done to you and starts being about you. As I've said before, the most devastating mental state I could ever wish upon someone is a sense of helplessness, a sense that they are not in control of themselves or their destiny. To be helpless to change your circumstances is to be totally disempowered. And to be disempowered is to be resentful, depressed, and unable to succeed. It's akin to being a bystander in your own life, watching from the bleachers while others scrimmage on the field below. It is the quickest path to despair and victimhood, a dark hole from which it is increasingly difficult to escape because the draw of self-pity is so utterly powerful. Self-pity is an easy and natural emotion to embrace. The shirking of accountability for your circumstances is easy to do. It feels as if you are unburdening yourself of life, responsibilities, and hardships. But this relief is only temporary and offers no lasting benefit. This is how people in the most prosperous nation on earth, with all their material needs met and a standard of living that is the envy of the world, end up anxious, depressed, and over-medicated. In a sense, this is the difference between normal citizens and the abnormal outraged. One tells stories about what they've done, and the other tells stories about what was done to them. One is about accomplishment, the other, grievance. These narratives matter. We're designed as people to think in narrative, bringing to bear the full range of our God-given reason and emotion, both to arrive at an understanding of ourselves and our place in the world. Stories are practice runs for the mind. We hear them, we read them, and we act out our own role within them. The only way to resist that warm blanket of self-pity is to tell yourself a different story. It can be supremely difficult because taking responsibility for your circumstances is always difficult and often seems unfair. When we fail to achieve a goal, make a timeline, or be there for a friend when they need us, we default to outside forces to explain why. To admit we had control over that outcome would be to admit we failed, to admit we lost, and no one likes losing. We value winners in our culture, and rightfully so, and when we aren't a winner, the last person we want to blame is ourselves. Maybe you've seen the old 1970 war film, Patton. It's a great movie, one of Francis Ford Coppola's first big screenplays and a cinematic achievement in every way. The opening monologue, a version of a real address delivered by the real General George Patton to Third Army troops before D-Day, features General Patton before a large American flag, exhorting his soldiers onward. At the very beginning, he says the passage that sticks with me now. When you were kids, you all admired the champion marble shooter, the fastest runner, the big league ball players, the toughest boxers. Americans love a winner and will not tolerate a loser. Americans play to win all the time. Now, I wouldn't give a hoot in hell for a man who lost and laughed. That's why Americans have never lost and will never lose a war, because the very thought of losing is hateful to Americans. The relationship of an American to victory, to winning, has never been more perfectly expressed. That goes for great matters of war and peace and for small matters of personal conduct. I love to win. My competitive instinct has been sharp and present since I was a young boy, giving it my all on the soccer fields of Houston, Quito, and Bogota. I always had a desire to excel. I decided when I was young to become a SEAL, less out of patriotism, though that was there, than a desire to be the very best. If you told me there was something better than a SEAL, well, I probably would have gone for that instead. The other side of that coin is obvious. I hate to lose. My father tells me that when I was young and on the soccer field, failure was the one trial that changed my countenance and darkened my demeanor. Nearly anything else could happen. I could get tripped, kicked, badly injured, exhausted, dehydrated, anything. It might tire or hurt me, but none of it would dispirit me. But failure would. Losing to a better runner, a superior player, an impenetrable defender, an outstanding goalie, all these things gnawed at me in the ways that nothing else did. I never blamed them. They were only doing what I sought to do to them. I blamed myself. I knew I could do better. I knew I must. Worst of all were the moments when defeat came not at the hands of others, but by my own doing. When I didn't work hard enough, when I failed to try, when I quit. Those were the episodes that dug deeply into my soul and psyche. That was real failure, because I failed myself. Americans love a winner and will not tolerate a loser. True, but that was World War II stuff, the era of the greatest generation, when losing wasn't an option. We're in a different generation now. If you removed from Patton and his heroic Third Army, we still love winners, but here's the thing. Eventually, we are all going to lose. Every one of us, even SEALs, especially SEALs. In fact, we are so used to failing that it's like second nature. It starts in buds. Our bodies break. The instructors are never happy with our performance. Nothing is ever good enough. The mantra, "It pays to be a winner," is true in the deepest sense because the winner is rewarded in buds. Boat crews who win their races get to rest or sit by the fire. The losers suffer, just as they would in combat. The top five finishers of the two-mile race on Tuesday of Hell Week don't have to run the race a second time. Where there are winners, there are also losers. In training, our scenarios are basically a long string of failures that we must overcome. And then in the debrief, we tell each other how screwed up we are and why we need to train harder. In combat, we sometimes fail to bring all our guys home. The worst failure. When failure comes, there are a series of questions we have to ask ourselves. Which actions of mine caused this? What could I have done differently? What will I do when and if it happens again? Note something important about these three questions. They're all inwardly focused. They're all about personal responsibility. They all accept and face circumstances. Let's make the questions outward-facing and see how they look. Whose fault was it? What do they need to change? How was I wronged? Why did my boss or professor not set me up for success? They asked too much of me, so why are they blaming me for falling short? How could I be expected to focus on my goal when there is so much injustice in the world? You see the difference, I hope. The first set examines self. The second critiques others. Inward questions accept responsibility and open the door to improvement. Outward questions assign blame and seek to pass failure off on others. The second set of questions is a font of outrage culture. This is what fixation on institutional and systemic structures, real and imagined, looks like. An injustice occurs, or a wrong is done, or a failure presents itself. And the second set of questions simultaneously externalizes blame to a vague scapegoat and disclaims personal responsibility. The individual is able to concurrently maximize external critique and minimize individual culpability. The burden of injustice is shifted outward. The presumption of innocence is drawn inward. In his book, Discrimination and Disparities, Stanford economist Thomas Sowell spends 223 pages examining in data-driven detail whether the disparities present in our society, hiring, education outcomes, accumulated wealth, wage gaps, etc., are in fact due to systemic discrimination. Spoiler alert, discrimination is rarely the primary factor, if a factor at all. He writes, "Each fallacy seems plausible on the surface, but that is what makes it worthwhile to scrutinize both their premise and the underlying facts. For instance, firstborn children have vastly better outcomes than their siblings. They are significantly more likely to be National Merit Scholarship finalists, have higher IQs, achieve higher education, or become a member of Congress. Of the 29 astronauts in the Apollo program, 22 were firstborn or an only child. He writes, if there is not equality of outcomes among people born to the same parents and raised under the same roof, why should equality of outcome be expected or assumed when conditions are not nearly so comparable? It's actually easy to see why people fall prey to this unique form of self-pity and buck-passing. It's seductive, simple, and often yields quick and favorable results. Personal growth is hard work, and self-reflection is frequently unpleasant. It doesn't help that there's a whole industry out there fueled by grievances and propelled by narratives that tell individuals they're victims of forces beyond their control. Didn't get into the college you wanted? Sure, you could have studied more, but it's really because you are structurally disadvantaged. Still paying off your student loans 15 years later? Sure, you could have paid more than the minimum each month, and sure, you got a $50,000 a year master's in human services rather than business, law, or medicine, but it's really because the student loan industry is predatory and it's unfair that the federal government wants to be paid back after lending you money. Lose your marriage? Sure, you cheated on her, but it's really because she was so unreasonable that she drove you to another woman. Didn't get the job you hoped for? Sure, your resume had 3 typos, you had a stain on your shirt when you interviewed, and your handshake is weak, but it's really because there's a societal bias against you. Hard times maintaining the household budget? Sure, you could move to a town with better prospects for yourself and your family, but it's really because capitalism or trade or immigrants or whatever are holding you back. And on and on and on and on. We have a lot of Americans asking the second set of questions. Whose fault was it? What do they need to change? How can I avoid it next time? Which politician is going to fix it for me? Let me say, as an aside here, I am not at all suggesting that Americans should ignore real societal, structural, or institutional problems. They exist, and we should assess and perceive them with candor and calmness. If a female lawyer with a superior litigation record is passed over for partner in lieu of the founder's golf buddy, then the founder better have a damn good explanation, rooted in performance and results, for why she wasn't promoted. But those causes are not assumed. They can be examined through evidence and corroboration. And there are adjudicating bodies, the courts and company boards, that can determine if discrimination laws were broken. The shoe can fall on the other foot as well. In Austria, a man won a €317,000 lawsuit against the Transportation Ministry for discrimination, arguing that his application rated higher than that of the woman hired to the position. He too had empirical evidence of discrimination to take before the courts and was given a fair hearing. The opportunity for external review of external factors is a healthy and necessary and indispensable element of a just society. Bias and prejudice are the rawest forms of injustice, and I do not advise complacency in the face of injustice. What I do advise against is the automatic assignment of blame outward at the expense of self-reflection. Most of the time, there is only one cause for failure: yourself and your choices. This is a useful thing to know, considering there is only one thing you can control: yourself and your choices. Therefore, choose your questions wisely and deliberately. Be the American we need more of, the one asking the right set of questions. What actions of mine caused this? What could I have done differently? What will I do when and if it happens again? This is a necessary exercise because you will encounter failure at some point in your life, and having a mind properly disciplined to learn from that failure is vital to self-improvement, growth, and earning the respect of your peers. Let me walk you through some of my failures. Not failures in the sense I have described before, failing to make the team, for instance. I mean failures in the worst sense. The failure to react to hardship appropriately. The failure to ask the right set of questions. The failure to live up to the values that I myself have espoused. After I was blown up, I went through a lot. The recovery was a lot more arduous than the experience itself. Multiple surgeries, immobilization, 6 weeks face down in bed. I thought my limits had been thoroughly tested in buds, but my recovery proved there were new frontiers of endurance to explore. Before June 2012, I lived most of my life expecting to become a SEAL or expecting to stay a SEAL. There wasn't a lot of room for alternatives in my mind. When I was wounded, I didn't make room for those alternatives. As I lay on my weird massage table contraption and faced the floor for 6 weeks, I told myself that it was all worth it because soon, soon, I would be recovered and back on my way to SEAL Team 3. My platoon was out there. My brothers needed me. And if I admitted it to myself, I needed them. My identity was deeply woven into the SEAL community. It still is. So there, in the most helpless position I'd been in since I was a baby, I went full bore into a SEAL and military mindset. That wasn't so unusual, and there was certainly nothing wrong with it. What went wrong was that I expected the same of others. My wife-to-be was there. My family was there. My friends were there. Physicians doing their best to put me back together were there. I had no patience for those around me. A slight misstep from anyone was met with seething criticism. I was broken, but I was going to win and keep winning, as I always had. What excuse did anyone else have for doing any less, especially if they could walk, lie on their backs, and use two eyes? My expectations of others made me a very unpleasant person to the people I loved and who, despite my best efforts, loved me. My expectations were, at bottom, a product of the trauma I'd been through and my efforts to cope with it. But that doesn't change the hurt I caused in those days. I was keeping up a facade and expecting everyone to be a SEAL. I demanded perfect planning and execution, the right jokes at the right times, and discouraged any kind of sensitive or emotional discussions. I berated my closest loved ones who failed these tests. This wasn't unique to the worst days I spent as an inpatient in the hospital. It lasted for months, maybe even years. Our human temperament is like a rubber band, able to be stretched in the face of little annoyances. A patient person has more rubber band to stretch. Mine was taut, already at its limit. Patience was a virtue that I lacked in the most profound sense. I did and said things that I am deeply ashamed of. It was horribly traumatizing for those who cared for me most. Tara stuck by me anyway, something I am deeply grateful for. That was a failure. I'll ask for a little mercy on it, given the circumstances, but the fact remains I externalized blame instead of internalizing responsibility. It got better over time, but it took a lot of work, and it took longer than it ever should have. There is no excuse for treating those who love you poorly. My anger, my impatience at my situation, was not related to my sight, as many might think. It was tied to the fact that the Navy would not give me what I wanted. It infuriated me. It ate at my soul. My hopes of simply rejoining SEAL Team 3 and resuming platoon leadership faded as recovery stretched into weeks and then months and then years. Miracles happened with my left eye and vision was restored, but it was highly imperfect and erratic vision. My battered eye was clouded with cataracts, scarring, and debris in the ocular fluid. It always will be. 2.5 years after my first successful surgeries in 2012, I was still grappling with clouded, blurred, and obscured vision in the one eye I had left, constantly testing out new contacts to improve my vision. While I failed to treat people with the respect they deserved on many occasions, there was one small iota of redemption here. My ability to continue my career in a meaningful way, even if it wasn't leading a SEAL platoon. I did everything I possibly could to get back to my teammates. I was wounded in June 2012, and by October 2012, I was back on the gun. I requested to go to the Mid-South Combat Shooting Institute in Mississippi with a platoon from SEAL Team 7. Platoons go to Mid-South, the kill house as many know it, every pre-deployment training cycle to hone their close-quarter combat or CQC skills and shooting techniques. I knew that if I was going to regain my confidence as an operator and prove to the teams that I was worthy, then this was the place to do it. Mid-South is highly competitive. Every single shooting drill is ranked so that losers can be shamed endlessly. This is exactly how SEALs like it, and I was in an especially good position for talking trash to my teammates when it came to competitions. If they beat me, I could simply point to the fact that I could barely see, and I was shooting my rifle left-handed now. I lost my right eye, and I am right-handed. If I beat them, I could berate them viciously for losing to the one-eyed man with blurry vision in the remaining eye. It was a win-win situation for me, and I had the time of my life. I did live-fire house runs on night vision goggles, left-handed and one-eyed. I didn't screw up. I remembered my CQC training, a complex set of rules that dictate how we move silently through an enemy building, taking cues from one another's movements, clearing every angle and ensuring that the enemy never has an advantageous position. The tactics of CQC are far more intricate than the movies would have you believe, where two guys simply burst through a door and split the room. I did it all. I spent extra hours with instructors perfecting my left-handed rifle reloads and weapon transitions. All my years of muscle memory training had to be unlearned and then relearned on my left hand. I worked at it. I put in the extra time. By the end of the training, I was passing the key operator standards test that determined SEAL shooting competency. But this wasn't enough. Shooting on the range is one thing, but unique missions like combat diving were closed to me. Not just because I had no depth perception, but also because the low light conditions below the surface would render me effectively blind. Land-based patrolling of the sort I knew in Iraq and Afghanistan were out of the question. I would see neither men nor IEDs with sufficient clarity to make the necessary calls in the field. My limited field of view would make it harder to quickly spot movement that might be life-threatening. I had to wear a contact in my remaining eye. What if it got dirt or dust in it? I would be incapacitated. 2.5 years after the injury, and after many failed attempts at getting a viable contact, the Navy doctors finally referred me to a small firm called Boston Sight that specialized in contact lenses for damaged eyes like mine. I went, and behold, another miracle. The lens gave me 20/20 distance vision for the first time since the blast. Now, 20/20 distance vision isn't full recovery. I still need glasses to read, and my iris doesn't function. But from where I'd been, it was a long way toward a more normal existence. I was back. I was ready to rejoin the Navy and get out there with my fellow SEALs. The Navy tried to make it work. I wasn't going to be out there in the field with a weapon, but I could do the next best thing, lead teams that provide intelligence support to SEALs who were in harm's way. I was assigned to Special Reconnaissance Team 1, and in 2014, I returned to the Middle East, this time to Bahrain, where the United States 5th Fleet is headquartered and a considerable American intelligence and communications apparatus has long been in place. I worked throughout the Persian Gulf and even in Lebanon. In 2016, I was sent to Korea. It wasn't the same sort of thing I was doing, nor what I had expected to do when I dreamed of the SEAL teams as a boy. But I was serving. I had a mission. And that was what mattered to me. But in the end, the medical rules and regulations of the Navy could not be overcome. The Navy, years before, had taken me in and made me a SEAL. All the attributes, training, and experience I'd attained were still there, minus a bit of visual acuity. I could see my way to continued service for years to come. The Navy could not. I want to clarify something important here. I love the Navy still, and I am grateful to have served. Service is a privilege, not a right. There's a scene in the miniseries Band of Brothers where one officer says to another, "They took away your platoon?" The response, "It isn't my platoon. It's the Army's platoon." Well, it's the same with my time in the Navy. It wasn't my time. It was the Navy's time. In late 2016, the Navy decided my time was over. I came home from Korea, and I was given a medical discharge. That was it. That day, when I stopped being a commissioned officer and started being a civilian, was the day a dream ended that had begun nearly 20 years before, when my dad handed me Rogue Warrior by Dick Marcinko and said I might enjoy it. I failed, and I had to confront it. I had fought to stay in the Navy and to stay in the fight, literally since the first moments after the IED hit me 4.5 years before. I had walked on my own to the evacuation helicopter because I wanted no man carrying me who could be fighting. I had decided I would see again, even when told I probably would not, because I knew I had to see to stay a SEAL. I endured a long and painful recovery with the singular goal in mind of rejoining SEAL Team 3. I accepted assignments around the globe that were outside the ordinary confines of my former profession so I could continue serving. I did all that was asked of me and did it eagerly. I did all that, and the Navy still showed me the door. I tried, and I failed. It didn't feel good. I would be lying if I said there was not an internal struggle, where I vacillated between accepting defeat gracefully and moving on to the next objective, and wallowing in self-pity while I blamed the short-sightedness of the Navy for not recognizing the value I still brought to the fight. In the end, it wasn't one or the other. It was both. I allowed myself a degree of self-pity. I am not proud of it. I derided the Navy's overly bureaucratic and inflexible methods as wasteful and short-sighted. Why would we simply kick out a perfectly qualified and willing officer and then put him on retirement and disability for the rest of his life? Do you really need 20/20 vision and two eyes to deploy to non-combat zones? What a waste, I thought. I wasn't necessarily wrong, objectively speaking. As a policymaker now, I think we should be asking these questions. But from a personal perspective, these toxic thoughts were a waste, serving only to focus my mind and anger on the things I could not control. My self-pity was not a useful emotion, and I should have known better. Fortunately, that self-pity did not totally consume me. From the moment I knew the decision was final, I was looking forward, not backward. Despite my grumblings, I still knew a very important truth. Even if I was not totally responsible for what happened, I was still responsible for what would happen. I sought out my next mission. I completed my master's degree immediately after leaving the Navy, and I ran for Congress. My wife and I started an against-all-odds campaign in my parents' game room, competing with candidates who had millions of dollars to spend. We started the campaign with only 3 months until the first election. I worked for every vote and slid into the runoff by a margin of only 155 votes. 7 months later, I won the general election and became a United States Congressman for Texas's 2nd District, a feat which no one had thought possible when we announced in December of 2017. But even if that had never happened, even if I had ended up with a private sector job in a Houston area firm and stayed anonymous for the rest of my days, I'd still have a mission. My mission is my wife, the home we are creating, the community we serve. My mission is my role as a husband and my role as a citizen. Failure, when encountered properly, is often a gateway to a different sort of success. That success can occur only in the context of the right story. What do you call those stories? What are they? They begin as a litany of failures, bad luck, misfortunes, and undeserved suffering. They end as redemptive episodes, each obstacle becoming an opportunity because of the stories we tell. There are certain statements we make about our hardship to summarize these stories. I have to, or I get to. If you have to deal with something, then it is being done to you. You are not in control. You are powerless. If you get to do something, then it is being done by you. You are in control. You have power. I use this storytelling technique in my own life. I don't have to suffer through Hell Week again. I get the benefit of double the training. I don't have to suffer the loss of my mother. I get to live a hard experience and grow from the lessons she taught me. I don't have to wear an eye patch. I get to wear an eye patch. I don't have to wake up nearly blind every morning. I get to appreciate the gift of sight, any sight at all. This applies to all challenges, big and small. It's the difference between failure and growth, or failure and more failure. You don't have to spend hours a day searching for a new job. You get to network and seek out a challenging new experience. You don't have to be depressed about a breakup. You get to explore new relationships. You don't have to pay your bills. You get to live with fiscal responsibility and learn the value of hard work to make a living. If you're scoffing at some of these statements as unrealistic fantasies, go back and read the chapter again. You weren't paying attention. These statements are not meant to change external reality. Of course, you have to pay your bills. They are meant to change your internal reality. We are changing our perception of reality, not changing reality itself. And this takes work. Psychologists treat patients with intense regimens of positive psychology therapy in order to create better stories. These stories help us turn the suffering into positive character traits. There is ample evidence that suffering can lead to better character outcomes so long as our internal narratives serve as the pathway toward growth. At first, it may be an internal narrative, but that narrative eventually makes its way into reality. Remember the 2-mile run on Tuesday of Hell Week? The one where winners get to sit the next race out? During my first Hell Week, I was dead last, limping through the finish. 6 months later, in my second Hell Week, I got first place by a long shot. An internal narrative of perseverance resulted in a tangible outcome of victory. Going back to Dr. Allison's research at the University of Richmond, he argues that true leaders cannot rise to the occasion if they have not experienced and overcome suffering. He writes, "For an individual or a group to move forward or to progress, something unpleasant must be endured, suffering, or something pleasant must be given up, sacrifice. Humanity's most effective and inspiring spiritual leaders have sustained immense suffering, made harrowing sacrifices, or both. These leaders' suffering and sacrifice set them apart from ordinary people who deny, decry, or defy these seemingly unsavory experiences." Suffering must not be avoided, Allison is saying. I agree. In Chapter 8, we talked about self-imposed suffering as a way to build resiliency, confidence, perspective, and meaning. But resiliency for what? The involuntary suffering, life. And when faced with that involuntary suffering, we better be ready to tell the right story. If we do, there are immense benefits. Allison writes, "The paradox here is that if we avoid suffering, we avoid growth." Pain and suffering can lead to growth, and growth is good. But suffering, failure, or trauma can also be terribly negative if our personal narratives are not in order. The stories we tell ourselves are what ultimately lead to the character growth, not the suffering itself. In the Journal of Psychology and Theology, M. Elizabeth Lewis Hall, Richard Langer, and Jason McMartin write, "The role of suffering is not to endure it for its own sake, but for the sake of cultivating the flourishing life." Failure must be handled by taking responsibility for that failure, even if it is objectively not your fault. The military embraces this hyper-accountable philosophy wholly. If a Navy ship runs aground, the captain is almost always fired. But what if the captain was not on duty at the time? What if he or she was sleeping? What if the officer of the deck was clearly to blame through specific errors made? It doesn't matter. The captain should have trained the crew better. The captain is always accountable. In BUDS, the entire class is punished for the mistakes of one, every single time. If one guy overslept, the whole class suffers. Why? Because we should have woken him up. The punishment comes swiftly and decisively to the whole class, and especially class leaders. During my time as a rollback, in between BUDS classes while my broken leg healed, we had a problem. Somehow, the watch schedule, a schedule for students to stand watch at certain duty stations, was not up to the lead instructor's liking. I can't even remember why. It was something small. I hadn't actually committed the error, but it didn't matter because I was in charge. I spent the entire next week in January shadowing an active first phase BUDS class around, following them to every single evolution, observing. But I was forced to observe while soaking wet. If the instructor, a relatively small but mean SEAL with a multitude of combat deployments, ever saw me without water dripping from my clothes, I would get another day added to my punishment. I shivered violently for a week straight, to the point where even the first phase students looked at me with sympathy. In combat, if there is one weak link on a team, we all die. Personal accountability matters greatly. When one person stops taking responsibility for their actions, the unspoken implication is that they are expecting others to take responsibility for them. This is a toxic mentality for a platoon, as responsibility is slowly diffused until there is none at all. It is equally toxic for a society where more and more people begin to believe that others should bear their burden, that the government is responsible for their happiness, and that personal responsibility is nothing but a nostalgic throwback to a bygone era. The increasing popularity of an unaccountable existence should worry us. The pinnacle of failure is the refusal to take responsibility for mistakes and transgressions, and instead blame external factors. It has a societal impact, because an increasing number of unaccountable individuals make up an increasingly unaccountable society. Our culture begins to popularize the narrative that we are always victims of circumstance, rather than victims of personal shortcomings. Outrage culture is built around this sense of victimhood in the face of failure. After the SNL moment, I lost count of the number of people who expected me to be outraged, asked if I was angry, or inquired when exactly I was going to put this awful comedian on notice. As I said, my initial reaction wasn't emotional. I did not actually internalize his words or derive offense from them. I did not let them hurt my feelings. I compartmentalized them as information to reference, not emotions to react to. I didn't worry about what Pete Davidson had said. I worried about what I would say. And I knew I wasn't going to be outraged. I wasn't going to be the aggrieved victim that our petty outrage culture was expecting me to be. I don't expect accolades for refusing to throw a fit, for refusing to fire off one of those self-righteous tweets or Facebook posts that are so fashionable these days. What I did should be considered the bare minimum, assuming that dignity and respect are still things we value. We all have the choice to respond to failures in that spirit. When we don't make the grade we want, don't get the raise we want, don't get the recognition we want, don't get the parking spot we want, don't get what we want, sure, it can wear you down. But here's the thing. America is depending on us to rise above it. America is a country of individuals,